Hey, it's Tony and Melissa. Thanks so much for listening to our podcast.
Here are some of the best parts from today's show. Hope you'll subscribe, share, and like us.
Last week, we were talking about International Overdose Awareness Day, which actually is on August 31st. So the day before, Fairfield will be hosting its own vigil for, again, Overdose Awareness Day. It's not just to go with the what everybody else is talking about, but also it's to sort of provide some support for the many families, for the many people who are touched by people who they have lost or who are struggling with addiction this morning. And it's going to be an amazing event that is happening, I believe, on the town green. So this morning, to talk to us a little bit about this, just a couple days away from it, is Jelaya Green. She is with the Fairfield Health Department. In fact, she's the health educator assistant. Jelaya, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hey, how are you this morning?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for being with us. So first of all, tell us, for anybody who's never heard of International Overdose Awareness Day, what is the purpose? Has that been around for a while?
Yeah, so it has. So basically, International Overdose Awareness Day aims to raise awareness of overdose and reduce stigma around drug-related deaths. It also acknowledges grief felt by families and friends remembering loved ones that they have lost because of drug overdose. So it's really a day to remember and just come together to just basically raise awareness and around overdoses.
And my understanding is that you guys are having a vigil right here in our area. You're having it in Fairfield. So
yeah.
So what is that going to look like?
So we're going to have various speakers, individuals from local law enforcement, local officials, community members, and stakeholders that are going to come and talk to everybody about their experience and their careers and just personal lives, about the impact that they've seen drug addiction and overdose deaths have on people. We're going to also have like a candle lighting at the end of it and kind of an open mic for anybody to come up and that would like to talk about their personal experience as well.
Yeah, and I think that it really is a very hard topic to talk about.
Yeah, definitely.
And I think sometimes it takes a village to really feel like you can open up and tell your story, don't you think?
Yes, it really is. It's a sensitive subject, and it's hard to talk about it. It's really sad, and a lot of lives have been lost due to drug overdose, so it's a big issue that we're dealing with.
And Jelaya Green, she is the health educator assistant in Fairfield for the health department. And we're talking a little bit about the event that's coming up this week for Overdose Awareness Day. They're actually going to be doing it the day before, right, on August 30th?
Yeah, so it's August 30th. And actually, prior to the event, we're going to have a screening of a documentary called Overdosed, The Real Story Behind America's Opioid Epidemic.
Oh.
So this screening is from 5 to 6:45 p.m., and it's at Saugatuck Suites. It's also on Reef Road, so the same road as the Sherman Green. So people can just basically go to the screening and then walk across the street to the overdose vigil. And the screening is basically a tour of several small West Virginia communities that explains who and what are the real sources of our current crisis. And for more information on that, you can visit fairfieldct.org/fairfieldcares.
Wow. No, that should be really amazing information.
Yeah.
So not to throw this at you, Jelaya, because it is, 9:12 in the morning. And I know that I didn't really prepare you too much, but any kind of facts and figures as far as Connecticut is concerned, I mean, we've heard from Senator Richard Blumenthal, we've heard from other politicians how, it really has plagued the whole country. But sometimes it almost hits home more when you can figure out, well, what does it look like here in our state? I mean, is Connecticut up against pretty bad odds with the opioid crisis? I mean, are we looking at a lot of deaths or, many people who are struggling with this?
Yes, we really are. So even according to data.ct.gov, there were 28 deaths of Fairfield residents from 2012 to 2018. That's just in Fairfield.
Wow.
I know last year we had over 1,000 deaths in Connecticut. And currently, drug overdose is the leading cause of death in Americans under 50. So it's really a big issue. And there's a lot of people suffering in America and in Connecticut and even in our town. So it's really something that's impacting a lot of people. And it's an issue that we can prevent. And we need to just stick together and support one another to get rid of this issue.
And Jelaya, I would love to pick your brain on this if possible. And if not, certainly I know I'll get on the phone with you right after this segment and we can talk to the, somebody else at the health department. But I feel like you may know this. So vaping, You know, not to kind of switch the subject too much, but we just heard about our first confirmed death that was linked to vaping in Illinois yesterday. And, you know, in Connecticut had two people who were hospitalized, I think this month, who said it was linked to vaping. Do you feel that we're kind of going down that same sort of track? I mean, in the last 10 years, opioids have become a huge issue. And do you feel that, like, vaping and e-cigarettes are sort of bringing us down that same path where all of a sudden 10 years later, I'll have you on the line again and we're going to talk about this and you'll say, you know, this is becoming a real problem?
I definitely think that vaping is an issue. It's definitely, we definitely need a lot of prevention work for vaping because it definitely is a big issue. As far as where the issue will stand in about 10 years or so, I'm not really sure, but I definitely think that that's another issue that we're facing. You know, before it was cigarettes and now we're facing the opioid epidemic and there are a lot of young adults that are using vapes. So it is definitely a big issue that we need to also work on as well. So I think that it's bad, definitely.
Absolutely. Well, we are so glad that we'd be able to pick your brain on all of these subjects. Certainly not easy to talk about, but Jeliah Green, who's with the Fairfield Health Department, she's the health educator assistant. Jeliah, can you give us the information, what everybody needs to know for Friday's event that's happening in Fairfield for overdose awareness?
So basically, you just come to the event. It's really just an event to just support each other. So you don't really need to do anything. Just show up and, just bring, you know, support, and you can share your story if you'd like. There's resources that are going to be at the event, just in case somebody needs immediate resources, or anything, but you just really have to just bring yourself, you know?
Yeah. What time is that? This is
at 7 p.m. So it's Friday, August 30th, this Friday, 7 p.m. It's on the Sherman Green, which is on Reef Road in Fairfield. And also, like I mentioned before, the screening is also on Reef Road. That'll take place at Saugatuck Suites from 5 to 6:45. So the screening will be first 5 to 6:45, and then following it will be the vigil at 7 p.m. right across the street.
Fantastic. Jeliah Green, who is with the Fairfield Health Department, thank you so much for giving us some of this insight and the details into Friday's event. I hope it's a great success, and we'd love to hear from you soon.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate you guys.
With us here on the telephone line is Lieutenant Jim Perez. He's with the Fairfield Police Department. Jim, how you doing this morning?
Good. How are you guys this morning?
We're doing just great. You know, it's coming. No matter whether you like it or not, the legalization of marijuana is rampant every place. And, you know, I, for one, my opinion, I think it's a horrible idea. I think it's a terrible idea. But the bottom line, it's going to bring in money for these states. But my question always was, you got that breathalyzer there. If people are drunk, you can do that right on the field and know exactly what's going on. We need something for people who are high, you know, but those two things are so different. You can't do a breathalyzer for people that are high, right?
Right. Well, you probably can. In Connecticut, we do not do that. We do what's called a standard field sobriety test, which is the same system that's used in detecting alcohol in people that have been impaired. Part of the problem with coming up with a breathalyzer test really in the field is there are so many variants, like the temperature, you know, all these things have to be considered. But more importantly, can these things detect degree of impairment? Do they detect the presence some of these machines, like the one in California that you're talking about, it only detects the presence of THC in your system. It doesn't tell you how long it's been in your system. And let's just understand this. Alcohol is one thing because there is a window. It's scientifically backed data. There is a window. We do use a calibrated machine that has to be calibrated all the time. There's a lot of legislation and science mixed together in it, and it works. So when we get someone who's, and to give you an example, when we get someone who's, you know, driving under the influence of alcohol, you know, we do standard field sobriety tests, which means, you know, we kind of look to see physically if they can kind of, maneuver themselves, and if they can, it gives us reasonable grounds to bring them in. But once they come in, we then do the breath test, and it's usually on a Dräger machine, which is out of Germany, or some other type of machine, which can calculate how many parts per thousand level of alcohol you have in your system. But with THC, you'd have to test it in parts per million or parts per billion. So that's a lot more difficult to do. And I suspect that legislative-wise, the legislature is going to be very busy trying to figure that out, how we can actually test for it. As far as a roadside test, right now we do it just like we do for alcohol. So if we suspect that someone's under the influence of drugs and we have reasonable grounds to believe that they are, we can literally compel them to come to headquarters. And once they do, we can actually not compel them to take a test, but we can ask them to. In Connecticut, you have what's called implied consent, where you actually get your license because, you know, it's a privilege to have a license, not a right. So the state can remove that privilege. So when you sign for your license, you sign an implied consent that you can be tested for alcohol or drugs. But we would apply the same standards right now as alcohol. But I got to tell you, it's going to be a little bit difficult trying to get a system or a breathalyzer or a machine that can accurately detect that you have been under the influence of THC to a level of degree that it impairs your driving, and then be able to prove that in court is going to be a little difficult right now, I think.
So do you think that there will ever be an instance where we can test that correctly? Because, Jim, the only experience I have from this is when I used to be an anchor in Vermont, and the governor was this was his big thing, was I'm not going to legalize marijuana until I know that our police have a way of finding out if you are drugged and behind the wheel. And unfortunately, that's, like you just said, that is merely impossible right now to do. And so will they ever legalize it? And unfortunately, people are still legalizing. So, you know, what does that mean? I mean, will there ever be a point where we could find out, hey, you know what, you are too high to be driving?
Right now, the only thing we have is these roadside tests followed by the same kind of process that we do for alcohol. Or we also have what's called drug recognition experts, or DREs. And that is a collaboration between the International Association of Chiefs of Police and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, which is the federal government. And those are, they joined together and came up with this DRE program, but the steps are so much. They have to take vital signs. They have to look for, you know, pupil constriction. It's almost like you're taking medical classes in order to be able to accurately say that someone's been under the influence of drugs. Drugs is very different from alcohol, and I think that, you know, it's funny. Alcohol is horrible because when it comes to like crashes and things like that, it's absolutely horrible because, you know, it gives you that bravado. It makes you feel like more confident than you actually are. Pot actually does the opposite. It actually slows down your senses. It makes you feel kind of draggy. And that can be a danger in itself because your reaction time in a car can be delayed. And that's where the problem comes in.
Right.
But I don't know. It's going to be quite a challenge. I suspect it'll be a little bit of a challenge. But I really do have confidence that eventually a company out there will come up with the appropriate system that we can use to accurately detect it. But here's the challenge. Ready? You have to be able to prove that there's enough THC in the system to cause impairment while the police officer stops them.
Right.
Because that's the violation, right? It's not. But unfortunately, since pot can stay in your system for up to 30 days.
Who's to say?
Yeah, there can be many false arrests.
So like this California, this one that we're talking about this morning, that's still, even if they were to give that to you guys this year, it's still not going to help you.
Yeah, no, it's going to be, so much litigation would come out of it at this point because of the uncertainty. Again, when you take, you've got to understand alcohol, it's been studied for years through the scientific community and also through legislatures to the point where, you know, where we feel comfortable with the laws in place. But with marijuana, it's completely different. I mean, yes, we can see the signs on the road, and we as police officers will know that they're actually impaired, and we have the right to actually remove them, and we should. Because that's keeping the community safe. But later on in court proceedings, for a prosecutor to prove that, for a defense attorney to, you know, to protect their clients, I think it's going to be quite a fight in figuring it out. And I think the matter is going to be, was the person impaired by marijuana when the officer stopped them and brought them in? Or was it when they did it 2 weeks ago, or a month ago, or 5 days ago?
Right.
Unlike alcohol, that's going to be quite a challenge.
Yeah. Well, that's one of those times where I definitely don't envy being a police officer. Lieutenant Jim Perez, thank you so much for weighing in on this. It's certainly a topic that people have a lot of opinions on. So thank you so much.
No, you're very welcome.
It's 9:30. You know what time it is? It's time for the Coffee Break Chat on WICC.
All right. Every Wednesday at this time, we catch up with Bridgeport Mayor Joe Ganim. He takes a few minutes out of his busy schedule to speak with us. Mayor, how you doing today?
Oh, I'm doing well. I'm doing well. We launched yesterday. How are you doing, by the way?
We're doing pretty good. We're hanging in there. We're okay. Good things could be worse.
Hello to all your listeners, Bridgeport residents, and subtly to Bridgeport voters. You know, they have an obligation to come out September 10th in a primary, both Democrats and Republicans, by the way. I just want to mention that. Yeah. But anyways, yesterday we had a great day with, I met school children getting on the buses after the Board of Ed joined the city and the superintendent in supporting restoring the bus routes to the full length that was recommended prior to last year. And I think it was a nice day. There's a lot of happy kids. Some were happy the first day of school. Some were kind of so-so, but they were happy to have the extended bus routes back. I think that was a really good thing, and I felt really good about it.
Yeah, it's understandable, the mixed emotions from kids. I'm sure the parents were very happy about it. I was actually, we were thinking about you this morning, Mayor, just because, I don't know if you heard about what happened in New Haven, but they changed, I guess, a lot of the bus stops there. And immediately I thought, well, I'm so glad that that's not an issue in Bridgeport anymore. There are kids now walking 8/10 of a mile to get to their bus stops. And in this situation, it's just nice that there are more options for kids to be able to get to school safely.
Absolutely. I mean, I found it really rewarding to go out there, really just watch the our students come out, walk, get on the buses, kind of in there chattering up, being told to be quiet, you know, the usual stuff, and just kind of watching them launch off in the yellow school bus that we all remember we were in, with a kind of a little bit of a happy ending, at least for the beginning of school. So that was good. We're not done trying to champion as best we can our school district. We want to rebuild. I don't know. We're going to announce this later today, so you'll get it first. It's called the Building Bridgeport's Future. It is going to be the largest school capital improvement program in the last 20 years. Wow. And there was a mayor back then, a similar name to mine, actually identical, who launched one back then, and it resulted in some of the schools that we've seen rebuilt in the city now, most notably Harding High School and others over the past number of years. So it's time to redo it again and to modernize our schools. Some of the older, schools that can use modernization, anything from better technology to new facilities, starting with BASIC, which is already in the pipeline, for a new facility with sports fields. We'll announce that today, too. It fits on a brand new site for a brand new BASIC. But every school in the city will be looked at. You can go to the East End of Dunbar. You can go to Hooker in the Upper East Side. You can go to Winthrop and Blackham. And all these schools will be on the drawing board and will be committed to be tens of millions of dollars of city money, maybe as much as $100 million. Over the next 5 to 10 years, and then we'll be applying through the state program. So you're talking about $500 million, $500 million potentially in school improvements in Bridgeport over the next number of years. I'm kind of excited about that because we saw it happen once. This is the next phase of it. And we can't do enough for our children.
Yeah, Mayor, I know you were listening to our show because all morning I thought, I need to know what's going on at 2 o'clock today with this improvement plan. So you mentioned a lot going on, which is exciting, and we'll hear more obviously later this afternoon. But just out of curiosity for our listeners who do have kids in the school district right now, you said maybe 5 to 10 years. So when will we start to see these changes, I guess, in the schools? Like, you know, if you have kids in elementary school, are these changes going to be by the time they get to high school, or what are we looking at?
Yeah, no, we're launching... That's why I wanted to get this going. We've named and got together a task force, which includes members of the Board of Education, the City Council, members of the state delegation, because they're going to work with us in Hartford. And then what will happen is they'll prioritize as they did before. Where are the greatest needs, and where should we apply the dollars first? And so that'll begin right away. But the reality is you're never going to rebuild all the schools. Let's say there's your top 10. I don't know which ones they are in 12 months or in 24 months. But you will begin the process. Some of them will happen simultaneously. But to pick those that have the greatest need and begin to begin the surveying and then the applications and to get this going. It's an exciting thing when you see a Harding High School become state-of-the-art that can compete physically with any school in the state. I mean, it's just outstanding. And we want to see that in every school in Bridgeport. I'm committed to doing it. We're launching it today. It'll be the largest capital improvement program, I said, in 2 decades, where we left off some time ago. And we're all in this to make it the best district that we can.
All right, we're talking about Mayor Joe Ganim this morning, our weekly visit with him. Mayor, before we let you go, I wanted to ask you about Charlie Tisdale, community leader Charlie Tisdale, who passed away Sunday at the age of 86, did so much for the city, and he certainly is going to be missed.
He will, and, you know, there's a lot of us that have, and I mean this is most affectionately admiringly as I can, have Charlie stories about how he's impacted people's lives in one way or another. You know, I remember and certainly worked with him over the years, seen him on the political scene. He ran for mayor early in the 90s when I ran for mayor. But most notably, when I resurfaced, so to speak, on the Bridgeport scene and wanted to make, was thinking about making a commitment to even run again or get involved. I was at a Christmas party, and Charlie put his arm around me. I hadn't seen him in a while, and just told everybody, this guy should be our next mayor. He should run. He had a lot to offer. He'd been through his my trials and tribulations, as he referred to it. And it was kind of an encouraging thing coming from a man of that stature. But beyond that, he's helped so many people over the years, created opportunities where they weren't there before, was a trailblazer, as best described, and then continue to make contributions even in later life with leadership at ABCD, which helps so many people when they're in a time of need. You know, you can look at him from a distance on high as he was appointed by Jimmy Carter in Washington to a major position, but then at the same time to be so close to everyone with great needs in the city of Bridgeport and beyond. What a man, what a tribute and contribution he made to Bridgeport and beyond.
You know, I'm reading here, I can't believe it. He was executive director of ABCD for 50 years, and he just stepped down last month.
You know what? I used to ask him, do you want to keep doing this? It's a lot of hard work, and he would just sit back and smile and say, this is what it's about, giving back, helping people. And he just did it. And he continued to have the relationships all the way through that he had developed over the years, and they brought benefits to so many people. His relationships, the work he had done, the spade work he had done to create partnerships and relationships, he used it for the benefit of so many people.
Quite a guy, that's for sure. Mayor, we've run out of time. I'm sorry for that. Hopefully we'll talk to you next week. I know you're a busy
man. Thank you. Yes, we will. All the best.
All right, my friend.
Sometimes ordinary people do amazing things. Community Inspiration with Tony and Melissa in the morning. WICC 600.
And we're going a little outside the box for this week's Community Inspiration. Technically, this is a New Yorker who lives in Boston, but his nonprofit organization is making strides right here in Connecticut at Yale New Haven. Rich Horgan is the founder of Cure Rare Disease. We told you about this group a couple of weeks ago and how they are less than a year away from trying a new drug to reverse the death sentence for someone with muscular dystrophy. Rich grew up with his little brother, Terry, who has the disease, and since he was 12 years old, he knew, as in Rich knew, he couldn't sit back and watch his brother perish. So he worked to help him and so many others like him.
What I tried to do is I always tried to do my best where I was because I knew I wanted to get somewhere else. And that somewhere else was just another enabler to get closer to where I could affect change. And so in high school, I knew I had to be the best because I knew I wanted to go to a good college. And so I graduated top of my class and then I went to Cornell. And there I was like, well, I knew I need to do really well here because I want to go to Harvard. And so, you know, you just put in the time. You put in the time and the hours and you grind through it. And with the chance to go to Harvard Business School, it was a great opportunity, right? Grew up in a small town, really my first in my family to go to college. Have no business being at an institution like that. And so I was really grateful for the opportunity to go there. And it was there within the first few months that, you know, you sort of start thinking about, well, what do I want to do with my life? You know, they ask this really interesting question that, you know, I think is a bit tongue-in-cheek sometimes, as some interpret it as, what would you do with your one and precious life? And it's like, you know, haha, okay, you know, whatever. But, you know, you start to think about it, you know, you might as well shoot for the stars because what else do you have to lose? And in my case, there's a lot to lose. If I have the opportunity to try and get the message out there to affect some sort of positive change, for my brother, at the time, I really didn't know what that looked like. Then, you know, let's do it.
the big risk that you're taking. You're 28 years old and you're taking on this really either life-changing or life-dooming situation for your brother. Your brother is essentially the first person who is going to trial this next summer. What is that like? I just want to maybe understand what that feels like to be in a position where you either could completely save your brother's life or this is kind of the end of the road for him. What is that like?
It's scary. It's really, really, really scary. Sort of, you know, when you wake up, you think about it. When you go to sleep, you're thinking about it. When you're sleeping, even you think about it when you wake up. You know, it becomes all consuming. I was just having a conversation yesterday with Monkel at Yale, and I was saying, man, I don't think people could do this for their entire life, trying to help a family member, because it's just so emotionally draining. But on the other hand, there's this beam of hope and potential that we've just not ever had. You know, you're right. The technology has never been tried in people before. And that's really scary because things can go really wrong. But with the potential to save a life using this technology and have done the testing that can show that it has the potential to be life-saving, you know, I think it's a shot that you can't not take. You know, I feel fortunate that we're in this position. And I think your comment earlier about, you know, when you're 12 or 13 and now you're seeing this unfold in the next 6 to 12 months, I never thought about it that way. And that's such a cool thing to think about. And at the same time, it's very scary. So I think, you know, it's sort of being wedged in between these two positions of a lot of hope and a lot of potential and the potential to save, you know, my brother versus some very real downsides. You know, I think man's understanding of biology is young. I think we're doing the best we can. But time is not on our side. And so that's really the message of trying to get out there is this is different. This is potentially a paradigm shifting approach, and we need all the support that we can get. You know, whether this is a corporate partner who has a great retail presence that wants to partner with us to do a dollar ask campaign, or a listener who has the ability and means to make transformative gifts to the organization, or even the everyday person who wants to donate $5 or $10. You know, everything makes a difference. Everything gets us one step closer. And with this, it's not, with this organization, with Cure Rare Disease, it's not a black hole, so to speak. Here it's very different, right? Here there is a definite end goal. Here there is a definite outcome of what we can do and what we will do. You know, you're seeing it unfold before you right now. And so that's the ask at the end of the day, is this is a totally different approach. You know, mankind as a whole has generally not tried this before. The technology just didn't exist to do so, but now it does. And let's take advantage of it, and let's try to help a lot of people, because disease is an awful thing. And, you know, people should have the ability to have hope and the means for a better future.
Russ Heckman is here on the line. Russ, how you doing this morning?
Good morning, Tony. I'm doing great. How are you?
Oh, we're doing okay. Question for you today. The market is up and down on trade. Can you clear up any confusion that people might have about this?
Well, I think the answer is unfortunately not, Tony. But I think it's a question of what it means to us. And so, in other words, you know, up and down kind of every day on trade is leading to a situation where it seems like we've got the pain without the gain. So in other words, we went into this in terms of with China, hoping that or seeing that they needed to be taken on in terms of some of their trade policies. But thus far, mutual misunderstandings on both sides seem to be causing miscalculations and making it more difficult for both sides to make a deal.
So, Russ, my understanding is because of what's been going on, I'm assuming this kind of stems from with the Trump administration. And does this have to do anything with like the tariffs with China and everything, or is that a completely separate thing?
No, that's exactly it, Melissa. So, in other words, I think folks there's sort of a bipartisan view that China has been unfair in certain trade practices. The thinking was using tariffs and other kinds of tactics with the Chinese that ultimately we'd be able to force them to the table and make a deal. what I think has then happened in terms of my mentioning pain without the gain. We're looking for that gain in terms of making a better trade deal. But I think both the president and the Chinese have ultimately ended up misunderstanding each other in these tactics. And what it's led to is tariffs and lots of back and forth. And the pain is disrupting business. It is disrupting U.S. farmers and causing some harm, which in the short term might be okay. But if you look at what's going on now, it's looking increasingly difficult for either side to make a deal and not be embarrassed because each side has been very aggressive with the other.
Now, how long is it going to take for this to level off, or that's something else you can't answer?
I'm afraid that the Chinese may have concluded. So that obviously the number one objective of any politician, both our president and the Chinese president, is to stay in power and to look good, right? And I'm afraid that it looks like both sides may be starting to conclude that if they were to let their guard down a little bit and try to make a deal, that they could appear weak. And so I'm afraid that both sides may just conclude that they're better off President Trump going into his election and President Xi maintaining power over there, that they may have concluded that it's just best to not make a deal now, which I think is just another negative for the global economy, adding to what's going on in Europe, and then there's more going on in Brexit today. So unfortunately, I don't think it's great news for our economy and sort of the medium term or the markets.
I mean, and is it fair, Russ, to say that it's probably we're going to keep kind of seeing this market up and down roller coaster, if you will? Is that going to kind of continue, I would assume?
No question about it. And to sort of show you the absurdity of it in some ways, again, not making any political statements, but just show you what both sides are doing. You know, President Trump on Sunday night says, hey, the Chinese called and said they want to make a deal. And then the reporters, et cetera, call the Chinese foreign minister and they say, well, we don't know what you're talking about. So when you're getting to sort of that level of we made a phone call and we can't even agree whether our phone call was made or not. And literally you see the markets moving on that on Sunday night and Monday morning, whether or not a phone call was made. You know, that to a lot of experienced people in the markets and in the economy just, you know, makes us shake our head.
Russ, we thank you for taking the time. Thanks for clearing that up. And we'll talk to you again real soon.
Okay, thank you, Tony, Melissa.